Good afternoon. So last time we talked about reasoning about that virtual time concept we saw in the completely fair scheduler. And we reasoned mostly in that context where we didn't deal with the adjustments for waking up from some sort of sleep. We had this sort of basic intuition that sort of everyone starts out with an equal share. If they can use it, if they can't use it, well, that means that they're going to sort of always get priority over everyone else when they can run. They are in debt, you know, as far as what they deserve. And the time they don't use will be divided up evenly among everything else. Why about evenly? Well, because we'll run the thing with the lowest virtual time. And if everyone can keep running, that will sort of, you know, we'll take turns in that sort of round robin fashion in that remaining time. So after talking about scheduling in that way, we talked about multi-threaded processes. We mentioned that we're going to have a process with more than one thread, but it's going to be one process. So what does that mean? It means we have the same open files. We have the same process ID. We have the same memory. Now, we expect threads to have their own stacks, also their own registers. So we're going to allocate, you know, new place to store registers, new place to store information about whether the thread is running or not, and also a new stack. The new stack, well, since we have one common address space, it's going to need to be at a new place in memory. We can't just keep it in the old place. That's going to be our multi-threaded process, and we learned that we'd schedule them. Well, we were talking about scheduling threads, not processes. So each thread of that multi-threaded process will participate in whatever scheduling algorithm we're using. If we looked at the POSIX API for this, so we saw that there's a pthread create function, so which is sort of the thread equivalent of fork. Now, since it's threads, and since POSIX just made some choices, it works differently. So one way it works differently is that rather than, you know, pthread create returning twice, it only returns in the thread that calls it. The new thread runs a function that you pass to pthread create. When that function returns, that thread is over. And this makes sense why you want to do this, because it's not so easy to copy the thread stack. We aren't copying everything like we do with fork. We also saw pthread join was kind of like wait PID. And like wait PID, we can retrieve this sort of return value. In the case of pthreads, this is the return value of that thread function. So we saw the thread function always took a void star argument, void star being a pointer to anything, which we, you know, convert to a void star with a cast, and it always returns a void star return value. And in all the examples I showed you, we didn't actually really use that return value except for, you know, one little thing where I showed a dangling pointer with it. And the reason why is, well, you know, we don't actually need to use that return value to pass a value to the thread. We can just have the thread return something using any part of memory. Threads have access to all the global variables, to anything we give them a pointer to. It's all in the same address space, so we could do something like, you know, pass the thread a pointer to something on our stack, and when the thread finishes, it writes to that place. We have the thread write to a global variable. We had all these options for getting values back from threads. We didn't need to rely on some mechanism to send it between threads that was special. This was very much unlike when we deal with processes where we had like our exit status, and we had the OS helping us with wait PID to like get us that information, or pipes. We don't need that sort of thing. We just have variables that we can access from either thread. And we saw, given that, a whole bunch of different strategies for passing values between threads. We could have global variables. We could pass pointers. We could have the thread store a value in all sorts of places and pass values to the threads in all sorts of places. And the only sort of tricky part was, well, when we start a thread, we probably want to have sort of a thread running function that's kind of generic. Like we saw, we could like say, I'm going to have a function for summing the first half of the array and one for summing the second half, but, you know, that's not very configurable. So we're going to need to figure out how to stuff some information in that argument to make our single function do different things. And sort of the most flexible way is we could make a struct, pass a pointer to that struct, and have the thread look at that struct to decide what to do. So questions about things we covered last time or the quiz? Yes?
I have a question about
the
size.
Question five on the quiz, okay. So let me pull that up. So question five on the quiz. Sure. Great question is, why did thread A's turnaround time increase? So if we think about, so let's start with the simple scenario. Let's say thread A never had to compete with thread B, it's only competing with thread C. So previously, what would happen is the way our feedback queues would work is that thread A would always get priority over thread C, which would be running at priority level 0. And that means that thread A would take 3 units to finish. And now, thread A and thread C are both runnable, and about half the time you run thread A, about half the time we run thread C. So as a shorthand, we can say, okay, that means that, you know, we're going to take about twice as long to run thread A for as much time. Because, you know, we need to have 6 times where we choose thread A, and that's going to, on average, we're going to need 12 schedules to do that. So that means that thread A is going to take about 6 units of time if it's only competing with thread C. If it's competing with thread B, previously it would take about 4 units, and it's only going to take longer than 6 units because we have A, B, and C all together. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions, follow-ups, comments? Okay. Nothing else on the quiz? Yes. What exactly is CFS? CFS is the completely fair scheduler, so it's the scheduler that uses virtual time that's in Linux. So it also includes the other features we kind of glossed over. Well, we didn't gloss over it, like we ignored in our exercises, like adjustments for waking up from sleep and things like that. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so the primary mechanism, it tracks this virtual runtime. Yeah, that's the primary way it works. There's a whole bunch of other things that are part of the scheduler, like to handle multiple cores, to handle things that wake up from sleep, to group processes together, that we didn't go into that much detail about. Other questions? Okay, so I'm surprised because I had a lot of questions about every part of the quiz in the morning section. But I guess people had time to think about things or something. That's fine. Okay, so, so last time we looked at sort of passing values to threads, mentioned sort of our most general cases, like we could pass the value on our stack. And, you know, threads are all in one address space, so that's not a problem. So one thing that comes up with this is that when we run threads, we're allocating a bunch of resources to them. So we're allocating a new stack, and one question is, how big is that stack? And it varies, and we'll look at that a little bit more later. And we have a thread control block, and so these are things we have to allocate. The question is, when are these deallocated? And, well, some of these we can deallocate when the thread exits, but we have to keep some stuff around because the thread has a return value. So if pthread join, we can ask for the return value, so we need to keep information about the thread around so we can call pthread join. So just like with wait PID, I can call wait PID after a process is terminated, I can call pthread join after a thread is done. And that means we must be tracking information about every thread that has finished that hasn't been joined yet. And this means that we're using memory to do that. And often, and probably more so than with processes, we'll have programs that run lots of threads. And sometimes you don't want to wait for the thread with pthread join. That's not going to be an acceptable mechanism. And notably, unlike with processes, we like have other ways of finding out when threads get the results. You know, the threads can just put the result where we want them, and we'll learn that there's other ways of coordinating with the threads we're going to talk about. So maybe you don't actually really want to use pthread join. But But the problem is, well, there's resources allocated. If you don't use pthread join, you're wasting memory. So there's a mechanism in the pthread API to say, hey, I really don't want to join this thread. It's called pthread detach. So when you call this, it tells it that I'm never going to pthread join this, I promise. So please release its resources when it finishes. Don't bother expecting me to join it. It's not going to happen. And here I'm showing that we have, we detach the thread after we start it. Most likely we're doing it while the thread's still running, but it's fine if we do it after it terminates. That's fine. It's going to, either way, we're going to make sure its resources are released. Might say this seems a little inelegant. Shouldn't we just be, doing this when we create the thread? And we can do that. So the argument, the second argument to pthread create is thread attributes, and we can supply settings for the thread. And one of them is, do we start it detached? So we start it detached. We're saying I never want to join this thread. Just get rid of it when it's done. And we can specify that at creation time rather than specifying it later. Questions about detaching threads? Yes. What's the use case for this? So if we have some other way of getting the results from our threads and knowing when our threads have given us a result, we might not care about pthread join. So we're going to talk about a whole bunch of other ways of coordinating between threads. And some of them, are going to be things which would replace what we do with pthread join. Or we kind of have like a kind of example with this here where, hypothetically the thread I'm spawning is just showing a progress bar or something. And, we don't care about whether that thread finishes. We presume it's going to finish on its own. You might have cases like that where the thread works on its own and you don't have to coordinate with the rest of the application when it's done. Yes? So what's the difference between using pthread join and detaching a thread? So question, will pthread join with a null not deallocate? Pthread join with a null will deallocate. The problem is that pthread join, like wait PID, is not going to terminate successfully until the thread actually finishes. Pthread detach just marks the thread as don't wait, not being waited for, and keeps going. So the thread can keep running after you do this. Or if you start it detached, you obviously aren't waiting for it to finish. You're just starting it just like before, and you're just not waiting for it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes?
Do we always have to
have the
detach point inside of the child thread? Do we always have to have the detach point inside of the thread, or can you also have your where you actually made the code?
Question, is there a particular place I have to do the detaching? No. So unlike wait PID, pthread join and pthread detach and related calls don't care which thread you call them from. So there's no parent-child relationship between threads. It's just a thread in your process or not. If it's a thread in your process, you can use pthread join on it from wherever, and you can pthread detach from it wherever. With the exception that you obviously can't have a thread pthread join itself. Because that doesn't make sense to wait for yourself to finish. That answer your question? Question, if you have the detach after you call a thread, won't it deallocate too early? No. So detach is basically setting. So detach, I guess, we can think of it doing two things. If the thread hasn't terminated, it just sets a flag in the thread control block saying, this thread does not need to be waited for. If the thread has terminated, it cleans it up without collecting its return value.
So it has this sort of wait function in it?
So question, it has a wait function in it. So it doesn't wait, but if the thread's terminated, it has to handle that case and clean up the thread's data structure that would have been cleaned up earlier otherwise. So that, if it had been called earlier. But if the thread is going to terminate later, it's just setting a flag. So when it does terminate, we can do the work of cleaning it up. Other questions? And this pthread detach issue is kind of subtle because this is just a memory leak, basically. Like, if you don't detach or join, you'll just leak memory over time in this very hidden way, because this is not such an obvious memory application. So another thing, as I mentioned, we allocate stacks, and there's some default stack size. If you don't like it, that's another thing you can set in these thread attributes we pass to pthread create. So you can specify, for example, in this case, I'm saying the stack should be 32 kilobytes. And often in threading, we're going to create stacks which are relatively not that big. And why? Well, we might have applications which want to run many, many threads. So if we allocate large stacks, that's going to waste a lot of space. So you don't want to avoid doing that. On like a 32-bit system, we could run out of possible addresses for the stacks pretty quickly. So there's lots of pressure to have the stacks be small. Of course, the problem if we make the stack size really small is that you write some recursive code and you'll run out of stack space. And while the POSIX API gives you a mechanism to set the stack size like this, it doesn't really give you a mechanism to know what is enough. You have to like know what your compiler is doing and so on for that. So questions? Setting stack size. Okay, so something that looking at this brings up is that when we create a thread, we're allocating a bunch of resources. We're allocating a new thread control block. We're allocating memory. And that can fail. And we saw with fork can fail when we're out of resources. So can pthread create. And the way pthread create reports errors is a little bit different. It returns a value, which is zero if there's no error, and an error number if it's an error. The error numbers are these special E constants. So this is from the manual, the manual page. It says E again is the constant for insufficient resources, like out of memory sort of scenarios. E inval is if you supply attributes that don't make sense. E perm if you supply attributes you don't have permission to. There's some settings in there which are restricted to administrator type users. And this means that really I should be writing code like this. And this is not what I've been putting on the slides, and I'm afraid not what I'm going to put on most of the slides just for brevity's sake. But most of the pthread functions report errors in this way. And often you should check for them, especially things like pthread create, which we know we could run out of memory. That's a thing that does happen. Some questions about error checking? So, and I showed this for pthread create, but we have the same sort of thing for pthread join. The errors might be a little, there's less errors for that function, but like if you like pthread join an invalid thread ID, like that's how you'd find out. Things like that. And also we're going to talk about a whole bunch more of these pthread functions, and they generally have the same type of error handling with a few minor exceptions. Okay, so we've looked at how creating threads works, how managing threads works. We're going to talk next about thinking about correctness in threads. Because so far, we've looked at examples where basically what we did is we like started a bunch of threads, let them go off on their own, and then waited for them to finish. And often that's not how we want things to work. Often we're going to want to have threads coordinate, work on the same data at the same time in some way, or not at the same time, but work on, data without us waiting for the whole thread to finish sort of things, and have them cooperate in a more fine-grained way. And when we do things that look a bit more complicated than those examples I showed you where we just said we're going to split the array in half, it turns out that reasoning about whether the thread will behave correctly is really hard. And this is mainly because, the threads can run in all sorts of order. So we looked at examples with multiple processes. We saw, know, if we have different processes outputting different things, there's all these different orders that output can be in. So we have all that ordering that can happen, but rather it just being affecting the output, now it affects what things are in variables that are shared between the threads. And this is worse with multiple cores. You know, so not only do we have like scheduler switching between different threads, we also have one thread running on one core, one thread running on the other, and the cores might be at slightly different speeds. So you can have all sorts of orders for the operations that like change local variables or output things or input things and so on happening. And this means that the sorts of race conditions I looked at earlier are going to be very hard to reason about. So we saw our first sort of race condition when we said, oh, we have a thread running and the main thread exiting, and depending on who wins, we get different answers, different outputs. We're going to have more of those scenarios, more opportunity for that, and they're really tricky to reason about. And we're going to want to have some systematic ways of avoiding these race conditions, and these are going to be what we'll call synchronization mechanisms. So we're going to have interfaces that are designed to help us coordinate threads together and make them behave in a consistent manner so we don't have this non-determinism mattering. And as a motivating example for why we're going to want to be careful about this, I'm going to give an example of a more interesting race condition. And I'm going to have our hypothetical, not-so-realistic example of a server that manages ATMs. So our server, it works. We get a request from an ATM, and we process this request. So one of the things, it might be a deposit operation, and here's our deposit code. We get an account from somewhere, so we have a pointer to some memory that contains the account. We update the balance, and then we store that somewhere so we don't lose it. And let's say that I have lots of ATMs to deal with, and maybe, you know, like this get account operation sometimes needs to go to disk, so it needs to wait for like disk IO, or it needs to talk to something on the network. And maybe the same thing with this save account updates operation. Maybe it needs to like wait for the disk or talk to something on the network. So I want to run multiple threads, so you know, one person's deposit doesn't cause another one's to slow down because we're doing these, you know, reads and writes from disks or the network or something like that. Or maybe I just have multiple cores and I want to take advantage of that. So we might, there's lots of reasons why we might have a server here where we have multiple threads that are all handling requests, giving us code like this. We have some main function that starts this server loop multiple times in different threads. So we can do lots of different deposits at once. And this is likely to work reasonably well when our different deposits or withdrawal operations are all independent of each other. But things can get tricky when they're not. And in particular, this deposit code can get us into big trouble when they're not. And that seems kind of silly because you look at this and there's this plus equals operation. What could go wrong with that? Because it looks like, you know, it doesn't, you know, if we have two threads depositing at once, well, one thread's going to plus equal, the other thread's going to plus equal. Presumably they're going to get a pointer to the same account object. So it seems like we're going to have to deposit the right amount of money. You know, there might be some weirdness with the balance we report or something like that, and we have to worry about like get account and save account handling two calls at once. But if that's done, it seems like we don't have a problem, but we do. We have a big problem. And we even have a big problem on one core. And as sort of one way this could happen, it's, let's think about the compiler might compile this statement, account balance plus equals amount. So one way a compiler could compile this is it could copy account balance into a temporary variable. In this case, it uses the register RAX. It adds to RAX, and then it stores that back in the balance. This is something we might do if like we can't easily write an add instruction that accesses the balance directly because it's, you have to do like pointer dereferencing. Perfectly reasonable way to compile things. So let's say we have two deposits to the same account at once. So our first deposit copies the account balance, adds to it, then a context switch happens. So remember in a context switch, we're gonna save REX and so on and restore a different one. So in thread B, we're working with a different REX. We also add to that one. Then we go back to thread A and we write out the wrong value of REX. Wrong, why? Because it doesn't include B's addition. And then we also write out a different wrong value of REX in B, which doesn't include A's addition. And the net effect here is because we were just unlucky with how when our scheduler decided to switch between these threads, we lost a write. One of the changes we made to the balance went away. And now we have lost money. It just disappeared. Okay, so questions about this scenario? Yes? Is this similar to the idea of aliasing? So we have a problem because we have a shared resource. I wouldn't call that aliasing because it's not that we even have different names for it, really. The problem is that we're deliberately accessing the same thing. And so I guess, but you might say, like aliasing, maybe this is something the compiler could help us with. And there are things the compiler can do to help us, but we'll learn that they're not going to actually be good enough in any interesting case. Not the obvious simple things like an obvious solution might be make this one add instruction. That's not going to be good enough. We'll talk about why later. Yes. So the question, if the threads share the same memory space, why doesn't the REX update in thread A go to thread B? So even though they share the same memory, they have independent registers and also an independent stack. And REX is part of that per thread data. And the compiler, well, it didn't write code that's trying to do anything about some other thread's value of REX. So of course it doesn't deal with it. Yes? So the question is, if count balance is a shared resource, how does...
So in thread B, for when it
includes
REX with that count balance, is that basically overwriting the change in thread A?
Yeah, the question is, when thread B moves REX into a count balance at the end, what we have highlighted in blue here, is that overwriting the change in thread A? Yes. And that's just because we had some temporary variables that were unaware there might be some other thread accessing this shared resource. Other questions? Yeah.
So if the amount that we're depositing is like $50, what would the outcome be in thread A versus the outcome in thread B?
Question, if the amount we're outputting is $50, so we have two different amounts, because amount is a local variable for thread A and thread B. Okay. So the amount is $50 in both, we'd expect to add 100 to the balance, and we'd end up adding 50. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, so something that you might complain about here is that this sort of context switching seems very unlucky, right? Like we just have this really poorly timed context switch, and maybe that's really rare, and I think on a single core, it probably is rare, though, can we actually guarantee it doesn't happen? Especially since like context switches can be like triggered by network input and so on? Probably not. But more importantly, like if we think of like a multi-core, well, if this is a multi-core, we can have this sort of mixing without the context switches, right? Thread A is on one core, thread B is on another. And if we're running something like a bank, it's not going to be good enough that the scheduler usually won't context switch this off. We want some actual guarantee. We're going to see ways to get that. Okay. So why don't we work on thinking about race conditions? So I'm going to go through some examples of what could possibly happen here. And I'm going to start with this is not a trick question, the simple case. Here I have two shared values, x and y. I'm showing what thread A and thread B do. I'm asking, what's the value after they finish for x? So I want to give me the not trick question here. Yes? It's 1. And why is it 1? Yes. So it's 1 because thread A changes it, thread B doesn't. So what thread B does doesn't matter. Okay. So that's a simple case. Now let's try a more interesting one. So set one, give me any one possible answer here. So we have two threads, A and B. We still have shared X and Y. And thread A is setting X based on Y. Yeah. 1. Okay, so how did you get X equals 1? Okay, so this is, we do thread A runs before Y, before B changes Y. Yeah. 3? How did you get 3? Y equals 2, switch X equals Y plus 1, and then, okay. So 3, and yeah. 5? Okay, and this is, you say that thread B, runs in its entirety equals 4, which is Y plus 1. Yeah, so thread B runs in its entirety, sets Y to 4, then we use that. Any other possibilities? No one can think of any? Okay. Let's try this one. Give me a possible result. Yeah. 1. So how do we get that? So B, then A, okay. B runs, then A runs, okay. Some other possibilities? Over there? Yeah. 2, thread A, and then B, okay. Anything else? Okay, so it seems like people here are either shy or have concluded that, gosh, we're signing 1 or 2, one of those is going to happen last, and that's what's going to be gotten there. Right? But why not 3? Let's say we write x bit at a time. Right? If you're writing a bit at a time, we can write, we could interleave the rights of the bits such that we write set bit 0 to 1 from A and bit 1 to 1 from B and get 3. Why not? And we can have a similar issue with our prior example. Why not 7? X reads Y while thread B is changing it to 4 and gets this sort of interleave value. So there's something you didn't like about this answer, and your kind of assumption is we would never write the value a bit at a time. And we want to kind of encode that idea that, like, when we write x or write y, read x or read y, we're not reading it in pieces where we have to worry about the order of that. We're reading the whole thing or writing the whole thing, because that's usually how things work. And so we're going to have a notion of what we'll call an atomic operation. So this is something which either happens all or not at all. There's not going to have an in-between. So for example, if writing to x is atomic, we're either going to write a new value to x or not change x. We're not going to do something in-between, like change one bit of x. And this is sort of what you think of things working, and in fact, on most machines, some things are atomic. Some operations are atomic. And most importantly, so usually loading or storing words, and by words I mean sort of the natural register size, so like on a 64-bit system, a 64-bit value or smaller, is atomic. And that's going to prevent us from getting that 3 from writing x, you know, 1 and 2 to x at the same time. And I have this sort of caveat here that I say aligned words. So by aligned, I mean that their address in memory is a multiple of their size or something similar to that. If you remember talking about caches in a prior course, it's important that a cache block or cache line that the value is contained entirely in a cache block or cache line, that meaning that it doesn't span two different cache blocks or cache lines. Usually those operations are not atomic. They have to be loaded and stored into pieces. So usually loading and storing words is atomic. And I have to say usually, unfortunately, but most of the machines you'll deal with, that's true. Some instructions other than that aren't atomic. So notice I said loading and storing. I didn't like say adds, for example. So x86 has an instruction that adds a constant to a memory location. It's not atomic, meaning that it is possible for you to do an add, and part of the add will happen, but not all of it. In addition, values that cross cache blocks usually are read and stored and written in pieces. So let's look at the add atomic. I guess first a note about the alignment thing. So I mentioned that this alignment caveat, this is one thing your compiler usually deals with for you. If you have a variable that's a long, it's going to be at an address that's aligned unless you tell your compiler not to do that. So happily, our compiler deals with that. But let's look at this adding issue. So here I have a program to demonstrate sort of how adds work on my x86 desktop. So I have this function called update loop, which I've written in assembly, so I know exactly what the instructions are. So I don't have to worry about my compiler putting a value in a temporary. And what this does is it basically runs this while loop, you know, while arg minus minus increment a counter, where the counter is called the value. It's declared here. And I increment it by using one add instruction. So just one single instruction. And I set the counter initially to 0. And I supply an argument of 1,000,000 to two different threads. So if this add operation was atomic, if it happened all at once or not at all, then we'd expect that the total value of the counter would be 2,000,000. We'd have 1,000,000 adds happen all at once by the time they finished and we join the threads. So I get 2,000,000 here. And if we were on a single core system, that would happen consistently, because when we have an exception happen, if the add instruction is still running, the processor can't run the OS in the middle of that. It has to finish it so the OS can go back to something. But my desktop that I ran this on is not a single core system, it's a multi-core system. And I looked at the results I got, and here's a histogram. So our expected value, 2,000,000, is over here. You'll notice it has basically no weight on this histogram. And my actual answer is like 1,000,000. In fact, sometimes I got lower numbers. So this is just what happens empirically when I run this. So why is this happening? Well, probably what's happening is in the processor, that add instruction, that add to a memory location instruction, isn't run in one piece. It's run probably by internally loading it into a place in the processor, adding to it, then storing it back. So we have all the same issues we saw with our original lost write just within this single instruction execution and the multiple cores that are also doing it. And probably the way that caches work made this problem more noticeable, because if you're thinking about making our cache efficient, we want to not write things out as long as possible. They probably made this problem worse. Because they're doing what's efficient, they're not caring about executing correctly with other cores also accessing the value. That's not a big concern. Versus making this add instruction fast. So our add instruction probably is just divided into these multiple steps, and those can happen at different times relative on the two processors, two cores rather. And there's other things going on we'll briefly mention later, but that make this problem worse than just it dividing into steps. So questions about our non-atomic adds? Okay, so what actually is atomic? How do I find out? Sort of the general answer is the processor designer better tell you. If they don't tell you it's atomic, you better not assume it. Now, we, of course, are generally not going to write code in that way. Instead, we're going to rely on sort of things that like the pthreads library has implemented, where they have carefully read the processor's documentation to make sure, you know, the things we're using are atomic and will work correctly. And we'll talk about the abstractions we'll use later. But we're going to also talk about how they're implemented. And so for that, we're going to reason about, OK, if we have atomic things, what do we do with that? Right? So some operations are going to be atomic. What do we do with that? Okay. So to reason about that, let's go to this idea that, OK, loads and stores of words are atomic. That's typically the case, as long as we make sure they're aligned. And that's actually pretty powerful. We should be able to do lots of things with that. And often people say, okay, you know, I don't need any special mechanisms to help me coordinate threads if this is true. And this may be technically true, but practically speaking, it's not. And I'm going to go through some examples to show why, practically speaking, this guarantee that, yes, loads and stores are atomic is not going to be what you want. In fact, we're going to find out that we're not going to be happy with processors only having atomic loads and stores. We're going to want them to provide other mechanisms to help us coordinate between different threads and cores. We're going to have extra hardware support, this much hardware support. Generally, operating systems, you know, use more than that, and we wouldn't be happy on a system that only provided atomic loads and stores, even though technically it's enough. And to do that, I'm going to sort of use a physically motivated example. So let's say we have two roommates, Alice and Bob. They share a refrigerator, and they want to keep it stocked with milk. They don't want to run out of milk. So they have a sort of a simple procedure here that we're going to look in the fridge, check if there's milk, and if there isn't, leave for the store, buy some milk, and put it there. And if we just follow this procedure, you could imagine that this might be a program we write, simulating this. Alice and Bob are going to end up with too much milk. Alice goes to, looks for the fridge, looks for milk, says, okay, need to go get some. She goes out and gets some. While she's getting some, Bob comes back, looks in the fridge, sees there's no milk, goes out and gets some, and now they have twice as much milk as they wanted. So what would be sort of our natural solution for coordinating this better? Yes? So we're going to put a lock on the fridge. So we're going to talk about an abstraction called locks. So what's a way we can try to realize that with our atomic loads and stores? What's that going to look like? So I agree that like having something that acts like a physical lock, that would solve our problem, but we want something that's analogous to the mechanisms we started with. And we're gonna go into why we went the lock thing later. This is the end goal, is we're gonna have something more complicated. But I would say, let's think about what our mechanisms can do. So these loads and stores, we can think of this as like leaving a note and reading a note, right? Leaving a note, storing something, loading, reading a note, loading something. So how would we, with notes in mind, how would we implement something that avoids this problem? And I guess I'm gonna give the hint that the reason we're going through this example is that all the obvious ways are going to be broken very subtly. Well, let's go through what the usual solution would be. Yeah?
Alice looks like there's no milk, puts a note on the fridge saying that they're going to return the milk.
Okay.
But
Alice leaves a note before she goes to the store, and Bob and Alice both check if there's a note before deciding to go to the store. Great. So here's the pseudocode for that. Does that match what you were proposing? So in person, this would work great. But there's a problem with our matching of the load, atomic load and store to this note scenario versus what happens in the real world, which is going to make this not work out. So, can someone tell me what's going wrong here? Yeah?
Probably, like, in the middle of Alice writing the note, Bob could also check the fridge.
Question, in the middle of Alice writing the note, Bob could check the fridge. Yeah, so the scenario which can happen is Alice walks up to the fridge, looks and sees that there's no milk, checks for a note, there's no note. Okay, she starts writing a note, Bob goes by, Alice waves, she's writing her notes, Bob checks the fridge, checks for a note, there's no note. And Bob starts writing his note while Alice posts her note and goes to the store. This is definitely allowed by this code here, even though in person we have this issue that, yes, we'd realize, wait a moment, Alice is writing the note, I probably should realize there's going to be a note. So, you know, This needs some more sophisticated fix. So what's a way we could, any ideas for things we could do to maybe fix this? Yeah?
Before writing the note, Alice can tell Bob that she is supposed to write a note?
Before writing the note, Alice can tell Bob she is going to write a note. So how can we, so that would work in the real world, except we need some way of like notating that in terms of loads and stores. So is Alice going to leave a note to Bob before she writes a note? And Bob's going to look for that? So we have to make it work in that sort of mechanism to map to these loads and stores. Okay, so I'm impressed that no one came up with the subtly wrong solution of leave the note before checking for milk. So why doesn't this work? Yeah. Because you don't know if there's any milk or not? That's not the main issue. There's a big problem with this code here, this sort of algorithm that is just stupid. Yeah. Yes, so we leave a note, so there is a note when we check if there's a note. So this doesn't work. So there's the obvious partial solution to this is maybe we should have the notes identify who they're from, so we can look for a note and know not to look at our own notes. So we can do that. So we can have a separate place for notes from Alice and notes from Bob, and sort of our atomic loads and stores, we could have like one note from Bob variable and one note from Alice variable, or like an array and we choose an index or something. Okay. And so this is better, like at least we buy milk if only one person's trying, but this still doesn't work. So what's the problem? And you were... Yeah. So a question. Oh, so your concern is that we can leave a note from Bob before here, is what your concern? Yes. So that's the problem. Is that we still have this time window when Bob can be writing a note, and Alice can be checking for it. And typically what will happen is that, well, we'll at least avoid buying too much milk, but we'll end up with a scenario like this, where Alice leaves a note, checks if there's milk, and Bob writes his note, observing Alice looking at this. Bob writes his note, And then Alice says, oh, Bob wrote a note, so Bob took care of this. And doesn't go on to buy milk. And then, before Alice manages to remove her note, Bob checks if there's a note and says, oh, there's a note, so I don't need to worry about buying milk. And neither of them take a responsibility. So this is another thing where, in person, like, they're next to each other, they're going to realize what's going on, but our instructions don't match that. So there is, in fact, a way of using this sort of note, you know, leaving mechanism that does have exactly one person buy milk, but it's very not obvious. And when I show it to you, the most common solution, there's probably multiple solutions. The most common solution is something known as Peterson's algorithm. And you're probably going to consider very inelegant. And certainly not something you would want to like rely on coding. We'll see several reasons why. But so any ideas of sort of what's the a big thing, sort of a thing we would change that would help us get closer to a solution? Yeah. So you're saying, what if one of them is more responsible for leaving a note? Yeah, so it turns out that the sort of canonical solution for this, we're going to make someone more responsible. We're still going to have notes from both, but we're going to have sort of one person more in charge. So this is sort of the Peterson's algorithm solution for this. And in this solution, basically, we say that we expect, you know, sort of Bob's note takes priorities, sort of basically what we're doing. We've kind of resolved the scenario of what if both Alice and Bob have a note, and we resolve that by just having Alice wait for Bob's note to not be there anymore. I'm not going to say this is the only solution, but this is a correct solution that indeed only uses atomic loaves and stores. I don't think you would have come up with this. I don't think I would have come up with this very, you know, probably. And there are lots of issues with this. So first of all, we have this, you know, this is kind of annoying. Kind of like to avoid that, but that's really hard to avoid with this scheme. And also, like, how would you show that this is actually correct or incorrect? That's really hard. You basically have to do something equivalent to enumerating all the possibilities. Sort of the proofs of these things are like, here are all the possible orderings. They're all safe, right? That's sort of the outline of what a proof would look like. And another sort of extension is like, this is with two people. Often we're going to have more than two threads in our programs. So you need to figure out how this extends to three. There is a way of doing it to extend it to an arbitrary number, but it's not straightforward, especially since, you know, these are not symmetric. That's kind of a feature of this solution. So while we absolutely could use stuff like this to coordinate our threads, it's not what we're going to do. It's not what we're going to do anywhere. We're going to rely on the hardware giving us some help so we don't need to do something this ugly. And we'll see what form that help takes next time. So questions are actual atomic operation solution. Okay, so I'm going to talk about our solution to this type of problem. And I'm going to talk first about the abstraction we're going to provide and how you use that. And I'm going to show a version of it in pthreads and in XP6. And next time we'll talk about how do you actually implement that. With the only thing we'll say right now is we need special hardware support. The normal instructions we've seen so far are not good enough. Like, technically they're enough, but we don't want to do that. We're going to have the hardware help us out, so we don't need to figure out this ugly algorithm, which is different for different threads. It's not something we want. So some definitions. So there's some vocabulary terms you're going to see a lot, both in this class and in the real world, related to what we're doing. And we're going to talk about doing mutual exclusion. So we want only one thread to do a particular thing. So only one person should check if there's milk and go buy milk. And we'll call a piece of code that has mutual exclusion, where we ensure that only one thread executes at a time, a critical exception. I have a typo here. This should be result of mutual exclusion. So mutual exclusion creates critical sections, code that only one thread will execute at a time. And we're going to have an abstraction we're going to use to implement mutual exclusion critical sections called a lock. So a lock is an object, kind of in the object-oriented sense, that only one thread can hold at a time. And what happens when you want to have the lock and you can't have it, you're going to wait for it. So an important thing is that, we're going to say that if you can't get a lock, you're just going to wait. So you're going to do something kind of like, this wait until we can get it, but in a better way. And the lock is going to be an interface for this. So a lock is going to have an object which has two operations. And I have two different names for them because we have two different APIs we're going to talk about. So I have the names that XV6 uses and the names that pthreads uses. So you have an acquire or lock operation. And this is going to wait until the lock is free. So if someone else has previously locked the lock and not unlocked it, the lock operation is going to wait. It's going to pause your thread, keep it from doing other things until it gets free. And the unlock operation is going to let others use the lock, meaning that they can finish their lock. At least one of them, exactly one of them, can finish their lock operations. And sort of the pattern we'll have is if we have some sort of shared resource, we're going to always acquire the lock before using it and always release it when we're done. So sort of in this algorithm, our canonical solution for the milk problem is get the lock to that's for the milk resource, then check out there's milk and buy it, and then unlock. So questions about our lock abstraction? Okay, so as I said, there's going to be different implementations of this. So the main one we'll use in the POSIX threading library is called a mutex. So mutex is basically kind of related to mutual exclusion, so that's where the name comes from. So you can declare one with pthread mutex lock, and then we have to initialize it. We can initialize it with this init function. It takes a second parameter here, and this is attributes. So there are mutes. So there are different types of locks, types of mutexes that you can enable. Null just uses the default type. But there's some settings you can change if you are a more advanced user. There's also a way you can initialize a lock without pthread init, where you can use this constant pthread mutex initializer, which will set it up correctly. If you don't set it up, if you don't initialize it in some way, it's not going to work. It has some data in it. We'll talk about what an implementation might look like next time. And then the usage is we have this lock function and an unlock function. So questions about the pthread version blocks? Yes? How do we know what resource we're locking? So the lock abstraction doesn't include that information. So it is up to us as a user of a lock to establish a consistent convention. So we are going to be responsible for tracking what resources are associated with the lock and making sure our code always chooses the right lock before using that resource. Does that answer your question? Yes. So you could imagine, and that we could have other interfaces that like might make make it less error prone, and in fact some other threading APIs that are higher level do that. The POSIX API doesn't help you. It just gives you a lock. It doesn't tell you, doesn't track how it's being used. It doesn't help you avoid like accessing a vector without using a lock. It's just going to let you do that. It's your job to track whether you need a lock or not. Yes?
Can you try to lock while something's already locked?
Question, can I lock while something's already locked? So with both the locks we'll be talking about, that is something you should not do. With the pthread mutex lock, I believe it is undefined behavior with the default type of lock. So meaning it could work, could not work, could break things. And with the Xv6 locks, we'll see it will always panic. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes. So there are some types of locks which do support that sort of thing, but they're called recursive mutexes in the POSIX threading library. We're not going to use them. Other questions? Okay, so Xv6 also has locks, which they call spin locks. We'll see there's a reason for a name, which is related to how they're implemented. So spin locks are declared as a struct spin lock. That's the object. And this, we have some code that inits it. This is typically run at boot somewhere. So there's some code that runs at boot that calls init lock. So that's a name for debugging that might be useful later. And then we have an acquire operation to get the lock, which will wait if necessary, and a release operation to release the lock. And you saw this in the scheduler code, so that's one of these locks. Some questions about the Xv6 locks? Okay. So, since we know about locks, here's some code that uses some locks with pthreads. I have two variables, one and two, that are global variables. And thread A tries to assign both of them. And thread B tries to assign both of them. But there's some locking. My question is, what are the possible values of the variables one and two? Give you a minute, and go see what answers you give me. Just give me possible values. And I mean values for the pair, right? So I want to know which values are possible together. Yes.
If we're in thread and the lock is already in the thread, does it wait on that line or does it continue on?
The question, if we're in a thread and some other thread has the lock, meaning that the other thread has passed their pthread lock statement and not gotten to an unlock, then we will wait before we return from lock. So the lock function never returns until we actually have acquired the lock and no other thread has it, meaning that if they had it before, they had to unlock first. Okay, so I want to have one possible value, set of values for one and two. Any one of them. Yes?
Is
Two and two. So one could be, so what do you mean two and two? Sorry. So one, two is, sorry. So two for thread A, two in A, and what would be one B? Sorry? So I'm asking, so you're saying the two variable is set as in here, right? Is that correct? And what do you say, what's the, what about the one variable? Where is that, where, what value does that have? One in thread B? So it has this value? That what you're, that your proposal? Okay. So we have two in A and one in B. Okay, so how did this happen? So what order did things run in to make that happen? Yes. Okay, so A1.
B1 and
B2 ran. And then A2. So that's an order which could happen. And this is consistent with the lock. So we had to get the lock 1 here. And then we got lock 1 and then lock 2. And then we got lock 2. So there's no overlapping locks. So we have the locks have the property that one thread had them at a time. So that is indeed a possible answer. I'm surprised that we started with one of the most complicated ones. Someone give me a simple possible answer. Yes. Yeah, so another possible answer is 1 in A, 2 in A. And how could that happen? Yeah, so we run B first. B got both of those locks, no problem. Thread A and, you know. And maybe what happened is B got lock 1. And thread A, you know, needed to wait for B to give up that lock. So then A ran afterwards with lock 1 and lock 2. Okay, questions on that scenario? Okay, and how about another simple possibility? Yeah.
1 in A and 2 in B.
So 1 in A and 2 in B, okay. I would not call it one of the simple ones, but let's look at that one. 1 in A, 2 in B. Okay. So how did this happen?
So
we run A1 and thread A. Okay, so our pattern is we run thread A, acquires the lock. So thread A is, I will use a different color for this. So thread A is here, right?
Yeah.
And where's thread B? Okay, so we're in thread B. So we stopped thread A at that arrow. And now we're going to run thread B starting where? From the beginning? So we start here. And we got to this lock statement.
Oh, wait. Sorry, I meant to say we started thread B and then you switched to thread A.
Okay, so we start at thread B where?
In the beginning. And then?
In the beginning? So which line? Before or after B1? Just before B1, like here?
Yeah.
Okay, and then we switch to A. So we start at the beginning of A, and we got to this lock, okay?
And keep on going through A.
So when we get to this lock, the behavior of our lock is gonna wait till the lock is free. Is the lock free right now? So it's not free because B has it. Because B locked it and didn't unlock it. So we go to 1 in thread B, and then we release the lock? Which lock? Lock one? So in order for thread B to release lock one, we have to acquire lock two first. Just because that's how the code works, we don't get to the unlock. Okay, so questions? And this is the key thing we need to like step through to realize why, and probably the hardest part of this problem, why this is not actually possible. And the reason why is because that the way that lock works, you wanted to try to squeeze in A between these two. And so you're trying to do that, and you realize you couldn't because of this lock, and that's precisely the problem. So we know we can't actually squeeze A between the two Bs, A1 and A2 between B1 and B2 because of that lock. And that's the sort of thing to look for. And it's also the hardest part of this problem because it's proving something isn't possible rather than proving something is. Okay. Questions on that? Or from anyone? Yes. Yeah, so the easy one I was expecting is 1 in A, 2 in B, which is just we run, how about that? Thank you. And now my writing is gone. Great. That's there, and this is here. So the easiest one, sorry, I forgot I lost my writing to, except for the video. Is 1 in B, 2 in B is easy, and 1 in A, 2 in A is easy. These are both the sort of simplest cases where we just do B1, B2, A1, A2, or B1, B2 last. So we do A1, A2, or we do B first and then A. B1, B2, A1, A2. And the other order was that we could do, so we can have A1 run, and then we can run all of B in between A1 and A2. That's fine. But we can't do the opposite of that. This is not allowed because B holds lock 1. So we can't run A1. Rather, like, even just we can't start A1 in between the two because of that lock. So questions, reasoning, and sorry for goofing my presenter tool. Okay. So I think, don't think we have enough time to do this, and so probably finish up here. I didn't do this in the morning lecture, but this is my use lots of time. Because people do, I found that people want me to practice going over what's possible with multiple threads and just looks. But I don't think we have enough time to actually go through this in 2 minutes, so see you all next time.